exposure to the British media. But on the last question of the day, the BBC's Webb asked Walker a question that made international news.
Are you comfortable with the idea of evolution? Do you believe in it? Do you accept it?
For me, I'm going to punt on that one as well.
No.
Really? That's a question a politician shouldn't be involved in one way or the other, right? So I'm going to leave that up to you.
Any British politician, right or left wing, would laugh and say, yes, of course evolution's true.
But to me, I said it's just one of those where I'm here to talk about trade, not to pontificate that. Another issue.
The governor's campaign later issued a statement from Walker saying, quote, both science and my faith dictate my belief that we are created by God, adding, quote, I believe faith and science are compatible and go hand in hand. It was more of an answer than Walker gave in London, but likely not enough to keep Walker from being asked about it again when he returns to the U.S. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now 11 minutes after 8 o'clock, the morning show with Greg Berg will start just a couple minutes later than usual this morning. An organization that distributes food for the hungry says that food pantries and meal sites will get busier if Governor Scott Walker's proposal to drug test all recipients of food share and other public benefits goes through. We get details on that from Shemaine Mills.
Governor Walker has said Wisconsin would seek a federal waiver if the legislature approves his proposal to drug test those on food share. Madison Mayor Paul Soglin says chances of getting federal permission are minimal. Moreover, Soglin says the governor's proposal misses the mark.
Why in America's Dairyland do we have a state government focused on depriving people of food when they ought to be helping us grow an economy based on food?
Governor Walker said drug tests for those on public assistance like food share will help people get work. Critics say it could end up costing more to administer drug tests than the state would save by denying benefits. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
12 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is up in just a little bit. First, let's check WGTD sports and weather. NBA, the Bucks beat Sacramento 111-103. The Bulls were off. Tonight, the Bucks are off and the Bulls host Cleveland. In the National Hockey League, the Blackhawks lost to Vancouver in overtime 5-4. Now the WGTD extended forecast from the National Weather Service. Today, sunny, windy, and cold, a high of 10 above. Overnight, cloudy, very cold, a low of 2 above zero. For Friday, cloudy, 40% chance of light snow. Tomorrow's high 22. Then a cold weekend, 10 degrees both Saturday and Sunday for the high. This morning, wind is from the northwest at 13. Sunshine, a blue sky, a pretty looking day, but it's cold, 7 above. Racine in Kenosha, 4 above for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill 10 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News Time, 8:13. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have a two-part morning show for you today. Part two is going to feature a conversation with a talented writer who also happens to be an expert on St. Valentine, the historic figure St. Valentine. But in part one, you're going to hear my conversation with contralto Meredith Arity, who is going to be the headliner for an opera concert coming up this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church here in Kenosha, a concert that I am thrilled to be participating in as host and pianist. And ahead of my conversation, which I recorded yesterday, I want to play for you something which is available actually on YouTube if you type in the name Meredith Arity, A-R-W-A-D-Y, one of the top choices that will appear is this is this special little feature that was done, I believe, by the Kalamazoo News on the occasion of Meredith's appearance in one of the lead roles in Giuseppe Verdi's Falstaff. So this is filmed in one of the dressing rooms at the Lyrics. You'll hear her singing a few notes and in conversation with this reporter, and then she proceeds to talk about the experience of being an opera singer just a bit. So let's share just a little bit of that ahead of my recorded conversation with contralto Meredith Arwady.
Called pin curling in her lovely way. And what it is it's getting my hair as flat as possible, so when they put the wig cap on and then the wig on, it's not bumpy and there's something to secure the wig to. That's where I get my Botox. It's very exciting. So you'll probably be able to hear in a little bit other people warming up in their dressing rooms. And it's funny, many people have many different styles of warming up. And actually, that's one of the most, it's one of the easiest ways to figure out who studied with which teacher. And who, it's very funny. You can be at a competition and hear other people and you can't see them, but based on their warm-ups, you know that they studied with your teacher. I was never much of a makeup fan growing up, nor am I so much of a fan now. On the way to church, my mother used to pass around a tube of lipstick and be like, put some on, all the girls.
Oh, no.
But, so this is fun. You get your chance to really dress up. And
okay, now look up.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The time now is 7 o'clock. This is your 1 half-hour call. 30 minutes, 30 minutes, please, to the top of Falstaff. 30 minutes, please.
So this is our fifth show out of 9, which is nice to do such a nice long run because, you know, over the course of your time, you feel much more comfortable with the tempos, with everything going on, and it becomes... it becomes something different by the end of the show. Just like that. Fairly Scarlett O'Hara.
At this point, she's being strapped into the skirt she'll be wearing.
So you also tend to warm up for the role. This role is much lower and also a lot of chest voice.
Mm-hmm.
So as opposed to some roles where it might
15
have to
minutes
go...
please. 15 minutes to the top of Falstaff. Once again, we're skipping the pre-show tonight.
Thank you, piano skills, right about there.
Rarest of all voice types, the authentic contralto. Again, this is an excerpt from a brief report done by the Kalamazoo Gazette on the occasion of Meredith Arwady's debut in a leading role at the Lyric Opera of Chicago. It's 20 minutes after 8 o'clock, and now I'm pleased to share with you the interview recorded with her as part one of today's morning show here on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Many WGTD listeners are well acquainted with the Fine Arts at First series, which has shared with the community all kinds of marvelous artistic and musical opportunities and experiences for the Kenosha and Racine communities. And coming up this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock is something that promises to be a very exciting program indeed, dedicated to the wonderful world of opera, something which I love very, very much, and a program in which a number of different singers will participate to help demonstrate the extraordinary breadth and variety that can be found in opera. Headlining Sunday afternoon's event is a contralto much renowned by the name of Meredith Arwady, who has sung lead roles with the Lyric Opera of Chicago, the Metropolitan Opera, and with important opera companies all around the country and indeed around the world. And because of a connection that she has with someone who coordinates the Fine Arts at First series, Meredith Arwady is going to be part of Sunday afternoon's concert in a very exciting way. And it's a very rare opportunity, actually, for somebody to be in the presence of an actual contralto, one of the rarest kind of voices that exist in the world today, and particularly one of the caliber of Meredith Arwady. And so we have a few minutes to speak with her on the morning show about her opera career, what it means to be a contralto, and a little bit about what she is going to be singing as part of Sunday afternoon's program, Sunday at 3 at First United Methodist Church, a program which is free and open to the public. Meredith Arwady, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get the matter out of the way of how little old Kenosha, Wisconsin, and the Fine Arts at First series can play host to somebody of your exceptional caliber. Tell us about your connection with Jessica DeBoer, who coordinates the series.
Well, Jessica and her husband Todd both attended Hope College in Holland, Michigan, where Jessica was my year, and we were both music majors. And so we became friends, and she was a violist, and I was a singer. And so it was the world of staying in contact with people with whom you were friends. And it's very exciting to have different people all over who are involved in the arts, and it's a wonderful experience to be able to reconnect with her on this level.
Very good. You were saying to some students at Carthage the other day that in fact your operatic experience at Hope College was relatively slight, although maybe sort of normal for a small liberal arts college. When you began your studies at Hope College, were you already a really serious singer, aspiring maybe to the world of opera, or did that only come later?
Well, when I began at Hope, I had a scholarship for voice, so I took the classes necessary, but I wasn't sure that's what I wanted to focus on. I was thinking pre-med things. I was thinking lots of different ideas, and it wasn't until I was already at Hope and I spent a summer at the Chautauqua Institution in upstate New York. That's when I was first exposed to opera as a viable way to spend a life, because I had done lessons and done musicals in high school and done choirs all my life, but I had not thought of it in terms of my vocation until the summer after my freshman year of college.
And tell us what happened then.
This is when I was at Chautauqua, and I'd been to just a few operas where I'd come through Kalamazoo and the like, but I had never felt much of an affinity for it. And my parents said, you know, why don't you try opera? You have this big voice. And I was like, no thanks. And they bought a book on the best summer programs in the country. And they went through it alphabetically, and they saw Chautauqua, and they saw it was affiliated with Juilliard, of which they were familiar. And so just on a whim, I flew alone to New York to Juilliard for an audition. I had no idea what I was doing. I sang kind of the only arias I had, and my teacher said it was like Ethel Merman belting the habanera, a Carmen piece. But she heard potential, and that started me going to Chautauqua for 5 summers in a row and doing my first operas in 4 languages and being surrounded by exceptional musicians and wonderful teachers, wonderful coaches, and just really seeing people who are on fire for this art form that I very quickly fell in love with.
Hmm. You are, as we already said, a contralto, which is an exceedingly rare voice type. And I wonder, even as you were a youngster, for instance, when you were back in high school, was it clear that you were blessed with a really exceptional voice? I mean, at that point, did you sound quite out of the ordinary?
Well, it's interesting. I've always had a very wide range. And when I was in high school, I was one of the highest sopranos in the choir.
Really?
Yes, and I did a jazz workshop at one point at Western Michigan University, and I could sing like the G above high C, I mean, way up in Queen of the Night territory. But I always had low notes as well. And so sometimes I would sing for soprano or tenor in the choir, depending on where they needed me. And so when I went to college, I wanted to be in the main touring choir that was going to Europe that summer. And it was usually closed to freshmen. And I went to audition, and I said, what can you sing? I said, first soprano, second soprano, first alto, second alto, tenor, anything you need. And he said, I need a second alto. And in many ways, my voice dropped. I gained strength on the lower part of my range, and I lost a full octave on the top that I'm fighting to regain note by note. And my voice just settled into a much lower and richer place.
Wow. Tell us about your experience now as an opera singer that you have enjoyed for the last few years now and gaining some notable successes at places like the Lyric Opera of Chicago and the Metropolitan Opera. How has this life proven to be for you as compared to what you imagined it to be? I mean, is it sort of as you expected it to be? What otherwise have been the biggest surprises, the life of an opera singer?
Well, I think the important thing is that it can feel quasi-nomadic. And so you really have to enjoy your own company, and you have to enjoy being in cultures in which you may not be comfortable with the language, you may know no one, and you have to see it as an adventure. And something I love, I've always enjoyed travel. My parents gave us the gift of traveling the world starting at a young age, and it's something I've always relished. And so when I'm in a new city or a new country, I'll go to the museums, I'll go to local theater, and I'll try the local cuisine. You go somewhere and you're like, I'll have that. And then it comes, someone says, that's stingray. You say, well, so it is. And you just try different things and meeting new people. And the colleagues with which you spend your time become almost a quasi-family. And sometimes different casts are more well-gelled, and it can really create friendships because you're there in the middle of nowhere sometimes, and you're doing this very intense job, and it absolutely bonds people. So it's sometimes daunting. I'm right now packing for being on the road for 4.5 months.
Wow.
And at one point, I had to pack for 8.5 months in foreign countries, and that stretches over different seasons. That is performance gowns, that is workout clothes, that is everyday clothes, that is heels, that is jewelry, that is everything. And it can be very frustrating, but it also can be an absolute adventure for saying, I am a packing ninja. And I am ready for anything, but you get very, very sick of wearing black. and you come home and all you want to do is embrace your closet and wear color.
We're speaking with internationally acclaimed contralto Meredith Arwady, who is headlining an opera program which will be presented Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church as part of their highly acclaimed Fine Arts at First series. Meredith Arwady, what does your family and what do your closest friends make of this life in which you find yourself living and jetting all over the country and so on? And what role do they play in kind of your ongoing life, a life which keeps you so much on the move?
Well, I think I'm very, very lucky that such things as Skype and FaceTime exist, because I was just working in Europe for 3 months and I would finish rehearsal, go sit out at Trafalgar Square, take out my phone and see my cute little nephews and see my friends and family and just talk as long as we'd like. And I think it makes it far more possible to feel connected. And also, in some ways, I think my family sees my performing as an excuse to gather. No, seriously, to come together themselves and to see me perform all over the place. And for instance, I was just in Madison singing my first Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd with Madison Opera this past weekend, and all my siblings were there, and both my parents and two aunts and uncle, my cousin, and it was just so wonderful. And I remember after our final show, the cast went out and someone said, "Did you see that guy in the front row? Did you see him? He was smiling. He was completely into it. It was so cool." And I said, "Was he wearing red?" And she goes, "Yeah, that was him with the glasses." I said, "That was my brother-in-law."
Ah.
And my brother-in-law was the one in the front row and my sister was next to him, completely engaged, completely into it. And we feed off that on stage. We feed off what the audience gives us as well. We can tell when they're involved in the moment. We can tell when they're excited about what we do. And often backstage, people say, "You know, how's the audience?" And say, "Oh, they're really into it, or they're very tired, or what?" And it definitely feeds you as a performer. And one of the best things is knowing out there is, you know, my 90-year-old grandmother was there. And I was in Santa Fe last summer. She was there for that. You know, she travels all around, as does most of my family. And there's nothing like feeling supported in that way.
Cool. Explain to our listeners who are maybe not quite so well-versed in matters operatic, the kind of roles that most often a contralto like yourself gets to perform, and the sort of juicy opportunities which they present to you, both vocally and theatrically as well.
Well, one of the nice things about being the contralto is that rarely will I ever be the damsel in distress, which is good, because that does not suit me nor my personality. And so often we'll be conniving, or we'll be sympathetic, or we'll be full of revenge, or we're the ones who tend to take a small moment to the extreme. Sometimes our roles will be small and will be considered secondary, but we can have a very, very large impact. And I was in a Wagner opera called Siegfried, and the opera itself is about 5 hours long. And I come on stage, and my part is maybe 20, 25 minutes of singing, but it's as high as I can sing and as low as I can go. And the orchestra, you know, 100-member orchestra is underneath you and the whole floor is shaking. And it's just the big brass sound comes in and it carries. And it's so exciting. And it's a huge confrontational scene, which is absolutely pivotal to the plot. And it's wonderful.
Tell us about the program in which you are going to be participating this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, a concert which is going to include a handful of very fine singers from the local scene as well, but you, of course, at the center of it all. And tell us about kind of the sampling that it will represent in terms of some of the roles that you have done and kind of the range of what you're capable of doing.
This is about as extreme and afternoon as one can hope to find in terms of the repertoire. We have everything from a beautiful little duet from L'Incoronazione di Poppea, which is one of the earliest existing operas that's still regularly performed, and which I have been a part of two different times. And it goes all the way from that to a song by Sondheim, which is from the 20th century. And it's great to explore everything from almost straight tone and blending with the local singers, and to absolutely as big and as loud as I could possibly be. And one of my favorite ones that I'm doing is from an opera called Un ballo in maschera, The Masked Ball, by Verdi, and my character is Ulrika. And it was actually in this role that I made my European debut. And it was a completely daunting experience, because usually you'll have a month of rehearsals and have a lot of time to meet the cast, you flesh out your character, to discuss all these things. Mine was a slam, bam, welcome, and you're finished. I arrived in Germany, and there was no one else from the cast. There's an assistant director who would say, all right, now you're on your knees scrubbing blood. I would say, why? He says, because it's written. I said, okay. And you have virtually no time. I was lucky I had one day with some of the other colleagues, but I did not meet the chorus until opening night. They said, all right, so you'll be surrounded by 60 people. And we're like, okay. And I had to get to the, I had to get to the door. I knew by a certain time, so these people I've never met. I'm saying, you know, I'm muttering in German, Entschuldigung, you sing for me. They're trying to get to the door through all these strangers as I'm trying to sing some of the hardest things I've ever sung in my life. And at the ending, we never had staged it. And we're on the stage behind it. And I'm with the assistant director, and he said, all right, now we need to get you on stage. I said, how? He said, I don't know. So we literally were crawling behind the set. And then at some random time, he said, all right, now just walk on, go look at them, point, and have a look in your eyes that says, I told you so. I said, okay. And so I wanted, I point, and down comes the curtain. I mean, it was one of those completely random, your adrenaline is pumping, and all you can think to yourself is just sing it well, and it will solve itself. And so a little snippet of that will be on the recital, and it brings back some amazing memories.
Wow. I suppose that that is, has to be a daunting challenge, and probably to some extent, maybe to a lesser extent, that's something you've probably experienced more than once. That is that experience of, under whatever circumstances, kind of being thrust into a production where there is little or no time to acclimate yourself at a leisurely pace, but it's time to deliver the goods. And I suppose that's when you get the opportunity to really demonstrate your professionalism.
It can be very daunting, but it's also exciting. You have everyone on stage and the conductor, and everyone is rooting for you. Everyone is trying to do what they can to accommodate you, and it's exciting because it's live. And that's one of the best things about going to theater, about going to live performances, is it's never the same thing twice. And the same group of people will never come together again in this exact same moment. And that's what's so wonderful about the opportunity to hear and watch art being created.
I couldn't help notice the other day, as you took a few moments to speak with some Carthage students, what a natural you are in front of a group of people speaking and interacting with those young people, answering their questions and regaling them with fascinating stories and lots of different insights. Do you have any specific aspirations at some point of becoming a teacher, a mentor in any kind of way, at some point down the road?
I think one of the most amazing things about this job is having, is the knowledge that's been passed on to me. And so many people in this business are so kind to try to help the next generation, to try to help. Very few people are less than kind in this business. And you, when I was young, I would be an understudy. I'd be covering someone, and they would say, "Let's, if you have any questions, let's go through some of your other things you're singing. I'd be happy to have you sing for me." And so in an official or an unofficial capacity, I love listening to people and talking to them and helping them understand some of the inner workings of this career.
Wow. Well, I know a lot of people are very, very excited about Sunday afternoon's program, Sunday at 3 o'clock at First United Methodist Church. Meredith Arity headlining what promises to be an exciting program of opera music, spanning much of its history and a number of different styles, and a rare treat indeed for people to hear a bona fide contralto of the highest rank performing in person. Meredith Arity, I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very much looking forward to the weekend.
We spend the next few minutes speaking with a very, very talented writer by the name of Ned Hayes, who has a most intriguing resume, I guess we might say, in that Ned Hayes, among other things, happens to be someone who knows a tremendous amount about St. Valentine. And, of course, we have Valentine's Day coming up in just a moment, which is a nice opportunity to talk about who St. Valentine is. And it also gives us a chance to talk with Ned Hayes about an absolutely beautiful novel called Sinful Folk, a novel of the Middle Ages. And it features some of the most elegant and moving writing that I have read in quite some time. And it's a novel that I am still reading and still very much enjoying and can hardly wait to finish. So for a couple of different reasons, I'm very pleased that that we can speak today with Ned Hayes about St. Valentine, about the Middle Ages, and about his novel called Sinful Folk. Ned Hayes, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg. Really appreciate the opportunity to chat.
Tell us, first of all, about your own connection with the Middle Ages, and at what point did this become such a source of intense interest for you?
Well, I think in college, I first encountered medieval scholars and writers and began to be intrigued by this idea of an era that looked backwards instead of forwards. I think often we are looking to the future, constantly inventing the future. And when you look at the Middle Ages, they really felt that they were dwarfs standing on the shoulders of the giants of Greco-Roman culture. And it's fascinating to have them constantly trying to reclaim the past and find inspiration from the past instead of constantly trying to look to the next big thing, so to speak.
What is it beyond that about the Middle Ages that makes it such a wonderful landscape under which to create a novel like this beautiful novel you have just written called Sinful Folk?
Thanks so much. I find it really intriguing to write in an era where we don't have many of the modern distractions. You know, there weren't even phones or cars or, you know, iPads or Facebook or any of these modern distractions. I think life was kind of stripped down to the bare essentials, the people that you cared about, keeping your family alive, putting food on the table, being able to understand your relationship to God and the cosmos. I find it kind of strips down to the bare essentials, and you can really, really think through what really matters.
And I suppose then for someone who wants to write a book that's tremendously personal, that is a great place to go then, or a great time to go.
Right, right. In fact, I first started writing this book from the perspective of the villain, in fact. A man, I can say that because just about all the characters in the book except for my main character are male, so I'm not giving much away. But I started writing from his perspective, and it just wasn't working. I was just describing his actions. And then I got inside the head of my main character, a woman named Mir, and she just took off. And her personal perspective on her experiences really sang to me.
We should talk about the historical event upon which this novel is based. And it's one of those events that I suppose history is filled with, in which we know that this particular tragedy occurred, and yet all kinds of questions surround it, and much is not known about this event, including even the names of most who were directly involved and directly impacted. Tell us about this terrible night in the year 1377.
Well, when I was in graduate school, I read a thesis written by a colleague in which she described this strange incident, a house fire. Five children were killed in this house fire, and then the fathers put the bodies of their children on a cart and took them across England, hundreds of miles. And that's pretty much all we know of the incident. It's said that they were seeking justice. I'm not sure how taking their dead across England was a way of seeking justice, but that's all we know. And so I invented a backstory for that and a reason for them to leave the village, and a very compelling reason for my main character to go with them and uncover what really happened. And of course, it turns out the murderer is one of the people traveling with them.
You do a marvelous job of painting a vivid picture of that terrible night and the fear and chaos that engulfed that small village. I just wonder how one does that when you yourself, I'm fairly certain, have never lived through anything like that or seen anything like that. I mean, right. How does one imagine an event like that and then bring it to life on the printed page?
Well, even more challenging, I think, is the act of kind of stepping into a woman's voice and into a mute woman's voice from the Middle Ages. A lot of what I did was read historical background for the area. So, for example, I have a very brief paragraph that describes the village that she lives in. And I think I flipped through and read about 17 different books in order to get that paragraph exactly right. And even then, in my initial drafts, I got a few things wrong. I had written a pivotal scene in the novel that centers on a game of chess. And I sent the early draft of the novel to various early readers, including the wonderful English novelist Karen Maitland. And she wrote back a glowing report on the novel, but also sent me back a lovely list of mistakes that I'd made historically. It turns out the game of chess wasn't invented for about 50 years to 100 years after my novel. So I had to change that entire chapter to change to a different game that existed at the time. So even if you do all your research and all your background and you kind of immerse yourself in the era, it's still possible to put our modern blinkers on and see our own perspective on the age.
Right. Well, it's good to have a friend who can set us straight when we make some misassumptions.
Absolutely.
I think you put it so well in trying to characterize the urgency with which these villagers who have suffered this terrible loss of this handful of boys being killed in this tragic fire. You write at one point, the villagers want so desperately to believe there is a reason for this loss. And that those words are written at a moment when they are a swirl in sort of a mass of various conspiracy theories, I guess we might say in more modern parlance. But I mean, they need to have an answer for why something so terrible would happen, and at whose hand or by whose hand it has occurred. I suppose, you know, whether it's 1377 or 2015, that's one way in which human beings are very much the same.
Absolutely. And I think that it was intriguing to discover how similar we really are to our medieval brethren and sisters, because our attempt to rush to judgment, whether that's, you know, the bombing in France or 9/11 or other terrible acts, we still have this urge to, you know, blame a culture, a people, a symptom that we can identify clearly, rather than feeling that sometimes terrible things are almost random, or that it was the act of a lone wolf or a person misguided Instead, there is this sense that we can control the world, that we can point a finger at a broader cultural movement and change that. And it's intriguing to see this self-destructive act happen throughout history. What's sad to see also is that continually women are blamed for individual acts. In this novel, for example, I have a woman who brews beer, and she's blamed for having a cauldron, which in that era you needed to do for beer. So it's interesting how we leap to suspicion and judgment so easily, and I think we still do that today.
I think from something you said earlier, I want to be careful that I'm not asking you to say more than you want to say about your main character, someone named Mir. But this is someone who is living a very intriguing double life, and this
right.
person is also very directly impacted by this tragedy in losing
a son. She's a very smart, educated woman who happens to go underground for her own reasons for over a decade, and she lives as a mute man. And it's really interesting to go back to that theme of things that continue in our era. Almost every woman who has read this book, who I've spoken to, has said, oh, I can totally see that happening. I myself need to conceal my own power or my gifts or my abilities because either men are threatened by it or I can make my way more easily in the world. The COO of Facebook, Sheryl Stenberg, I believe, wrote this book, Lean In, about women feeling obligated to step back from situations and hide their own strengths. And so that experience of having to hide yourself is still prevalent in our culture today.
It's so telling, this scene where Mir is rushing out to try to track down her son Christian, who she fears might have been hurt or worse in this fire. But she first takes a moment to spread soot on her face, which is part of the disguise that she always wears. And as she is doing what she calls my sooty ritual, you have her thinking to herself, the world will see me only as I intend. It is a type of vanity. If I cannot be a woman, I will be as ugly a man as I can muster. What an intriguing way for a woman in that time and place to, in a sense, exert an uncommon level of control over how the world will see her and regard her.
Right. And the novel is really about surfaces. What are the surfaces that we present to other people? What are the truths that we keep inside? And what is the surface presentation of her life with her child versus the reality? As the novel continues, of course, all of her secrets come out and you discover why she was hiding and what her backstory is and how intelligent she is. In that time, many people were illiterate, didn't know a word or a letter of English, and yet she can speak and write three or four different languages.
The book, just to remind our listeners again, is Sinful Folk, a novel of the Middle Ages, and it is published by Campanile Books. And before we let you go, we need to hear a word or two about someone whose name we all know, but beyond the name itself, most of us have no notion whatsoever of who or what St. Valentine, the St. Valentine, was. Tell us what you think is most important for us to know.
Well, to capitalize on the theme of surfaces, what's intriguing about St. Valentine is that there may have been three or four of them. We aren't quite sure who the actual St. Valentine was. It's probably based on a holiday the Romans celebrated 800 years before and had continued into the medieval era. And St. Valentine's Day wasn't really celebrated until around the time of my novel. People started thinking more about overt expressions of love. People could write more. And so Chaucer, who was one of my inspirations, actually wrote what we think is the first Valentine's poem. And in that era, because people were illiterate, sometimes lovers would memorize poems or would memorize songs and would say these to their paramours. And that was the origin of the Valentine's card. Instead of just buying a Hallmark card as we do today, you'd memorize a poem and maybe sing it outside your lover's house.
Ah, so that's your advice about how we should more properly observe this this holiday?
Well, if you want to be true to the historical nature of it, that's probably right. On the other hand, you could also unite fraught lovers, which various stories attribute to St. Valentine, and in response for bringing lovers together, you could get your head chopped off, which is what Valentine apparently had happened to him around around February 15th. But as I said, there are three or four different legends about who Valentine was, and we can't nail it down to a precise person. There is, in a church in Rome, a skull decorated with flowers that is attributed to St. Valentine, but that's really the only historical artifact we have for the person who supposedly brought lovers together.
Wow. Fascinating insights. Ned Hayes, I thank you so much for joining me today, and I congratulate you again on your novel, Sinful Folk. It's an absolutely beautiful work, and I look forward to seeing more of your writing in the future.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Happy reading.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be talking about a Special Olympics event, which is coming up that involves some of the athletes at Carthage College. On Monday's Morning Show, we'll be talking to the director of a fascinating film called Life Essentials with Ruby Dee. Ruby Dee, of course, a very, very talented actress and writer and husband of Ozzie Davis, also a very, very talented actor and influential activist. And Ruby Dee's grandson, Mut Ali Muhammad, has put together a stunningly moving and revelatory film about both of his grandparents, but especially his grandmother, Ruby Dee. And this film is going to be screened next week at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Ahead of that, you'll hear my conversation with him and with Sidney Mahone, who collaborated with Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis on a dual memoir. And we'll talk with her as well. That will be on Monday's Morning Show. Tuesday will feature Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, paying his monthly visit to the program. And the topic on Tuesday's Morning Show will be that of apprenticeships. And of course, apprenticeships have been around for centuries. But the new model conceived in the early 20th century folds apprenticeship into technical college education in some very, very exciting ways. And Gateway is a place in which much of that happens on to a very exciting extent. And we're going to be talking about that on Tuesday's Morning Show. And a week from today, next Thursday's Morning Show will be especially exciting. I welcome Nan Calvert back to the program for her monthly visit, and with her, a teacher or advisor from Escuela Verde School, High School in Milwaukee, and a student there, a senior, Ramon Rivera. And they talk about this very special school, which has a focus of sustainability, environmental sensitivity, and social justice woven into every facet of everything that they do. a very, very interesting story, and we'll be talking about that a week from today. You'll find the Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Sunny, windy, cold today, high of 10 above, an overnight low of 2 above. Cloudy tomorrow with a 40% chance of light snow. We do warm up to 22. Our temperatures retreat again on Saturday, back to 10 above for a high. Similarly cold on Sunday, partly sunny, 10 above. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake.